This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and we are at the end of another year in a reflective mood, looking back at some of the highlights of the show this past year. So we thought we'd take this opportunity to introduce you to the State of Things staff and ask them about some of their favorite segments of 2014. First up is the newest member of the State of Things staff, Hadi Mawagdi. Hadi, welcome to this side of the glass.
Hey, Frank.
Good to have you here.
Glad to be on.
So give us a sense. We want to find out a little bit about you, and one way to do that is to hear what you think was good this year. So what do you have for us? Number one on your list of things we did this year.
Number one on things we did good this year was probably a segment I did with Chef Vivian Howard that we did. I'm a foodie of sorts. I love to watch food on television because it keeps me from eating all the food in my refrigerator. And her show is on PBS. And before I moved here from Austin, Texas, I was a pretty big fan of A Chef's Life. And it just so happened that we could give a shout out to Chef Vivian Howard and have her on the show. So we had her on, and I guess I was just a little surprised at her upbringing, because you just imagine that all these chefs, you know, they've been hanging out with their moms their whole life and eating black garlic, you know, when they're little kids, really exquisite kids, you know. And she just wasn't. But I don't want to give too much away from the conversation.
All right, let's hear it.
I grew up on a tobacco farm, and pretty much everyone around me was also on a tobacco farm. That's what we did in Eastern North Carolina, and I thought that's what people did everywhere. From a very early age, always kind of dreamt of moving away. I wanted to order Chinese food and have somebody bring it to our door, and I wanted to walk somewhere other than to the car, and so those were my dreams.
Well, but these are big dreams for someone who, as I understand it, thought that Kinston was kind of the big city, and you had a little bit of an inferiority complex about the highfalutin folks at Kinston. Am I right?
Yes. I mean, we would, on Saturdays, get dressed up to go to town, and we would go shopping. And I went to a county school versus the city school, and I always felt I had an inferiority complex, I guess, based on growing up in the country. We were, you know, river rats and rednecks.
What did you think was going to happen to you when you went to New York?
I don't know. I think it was too much for me to even fathom. You know, I did have some interludes between the country and New York. So I learned that Kinston, in fact, was not the big city I thought it was.
What about cooking and food? What was your introduction or your sense of food growing up? Were you very interested in it, or was it that's just something you did? You ate?
Well, I always loved food, and I grew up in a family that really appreciated eating. Unlike a lot of chefs, I did not grow up at my mom's hip cooking alongside her. But I always, you know, was the first in line at the buffet table, probably, and we lived in a community that was very close, based on our family church and neighbors and relatives. And so we would share food during the summer. There was always a sack of new potatoes on the front doorstep, or pickles or preserves that someone had made, barbecue chicken on the weekends. So eating was very important to me. Cooking, not so much.
So tell us now about your move into food and the food industry in New York.
Well, I was working in advertising, and this is during the time that 9/11 happened. And after 9/11, a lot of folks, I noticed a lot of folks around me kind of quitting their jobs or deciding to go in another direction with their careers. And so I was very unhappy at my desk job. And so I decided to quit and figure out what I was going to do with myself. I was going to write. Well, I did not write. I looked for a job, and I had worked as a server all during college, and so I had experience there, and I got a job as a server in a restaurant in the West Village that, just by chance, the concept was Southern food via Africa. And for me, growing up in Eastern North Carolina and always eating just food, I had no idea that what we were eating was, in fact, could be categorized as a certain type of food, and that there were stories behind it. And so this whole experience working at this restaurant and learning from the chef there really opened my eyes.
What was it? Tell us more, because that is an important part of this, and I think on the food scene now, is the story, the fact that you can find the story and tell those narratives around food that just makes it all that much better. And you say you were a little bit surprised to realize that you had a narrative, the stuff you grew up with, you can actually create a story around. To what extent was it the food, and how much of it was the story that sort of pulled you deeper into the food industry?
Well, at that point, you know, this restaurant was just opening, so all the servers, we took a two-week-long class on the concept of the restaurant and how to be servers. And so the chef, lectured to us for days on end about the type of food we were serving, the stories behind it. And I was just blown away by his storytelling and the fact that the grits that I grew up eating were grits and that they meant something.
Well, so stop right there. What's his story behind grits and how does he sell that to a Manhattan audience?
Well, my story behind grits was, Uncle Ben's instant grit package in front of cartoons on Saturday morning with some Velveeta singles sprinkled in. And his story was, you know, stone ground, Anson Mills, heirloom grains, and the fact that grits were, in fact, poor people food at one point. It was a porridge. It was a way to stretch the meal, to fill your stomach.
Chef Vivian Howard of the PBS show A Chef's Life, the first pick for producer Hadi Mawagdi, who is telling us about some of his favorites from the year 2014. So, as you mentioned, you're from Austin, and now you're coming to a much cooler place, Durham. And if you don't have to go far to get to Wilmington or Asheville. So you're feeling like, are you adjusted yet? Have you made the adjustment?
I don't know if I'm adjusted yet, but I'm definitely getting adjusted, getting used to eating pork instead of beef. even though there's plenty of beef here, just pork prices.
Pork's
are really,
the thing.
Yeah.
Hey, what was it about that interview in particular that you kind of loved?
You know what I really loved is you don't really hear too many public broadcasting people calling themselves river rats, you know, and there's just something so charming about her. She's like, my Velveeta singles in there. You know, she has the voice that just it sounds so Southern Belle, you know, and she was here. She was so charming. She was so nice. And to think about her as a child eating Velveeta singles and grits and then to see the food that she prepares on her show, it's just like it just didn't make sense to me, but it works perfectly, you know.
We're doing Hadi Mawagdi's favorites today on The State of Things as we do producer picks, looking back at the year 2014. So what do you have next?
Coming up next, I got some music for you. So you mentioned I'm from Austin, Texas, you know, live music capital of the world. And as I moved here, I've had a total transition in the sorts of music people need to listen to. You know, we have the Bluegrass Festival. People love folk and country. Not to say that Texas doesn't have its own country folk culture, but it's different. Psychedelic and that, like, ZZ Top style rock and roll is really what we love there, you know. And so in following favor, trying to get used to the culture, you know, I went ahead and tried to find more bands that we could listen to here on The State of Things.
So you got Delta Ray. Let's listen.
The river, hold my hand. Oh, baby, it's a long way down, a long way down. If you get sleep or if you get none,
the cock's gonna call in the morning, baby.
And check the cupboard for your daddy's gun.
Red sun rises like an early warning.
The Lord's gonna come for your firstborn son.
His hair's on fire and his heart is burning.
So go to the river where the water runs.
Wash him deep where the tides are turning.
And if you fall, and if you fall, hold my hand. Oh, baby, it's a long way down to the bottom of the river. Hold my hand. Oh, baby, it's a long way down, a long way down. The wolves will chase you by the pale moonlight.
Drunk and driven by a devil's hunger.
Drive your son like a railroad spur.
Into the water, let it pull him under.
But don't you lift him, let him drown alive.
Your love speaks like a rolling thunder.
And let that fever make the water run.
Let the river run dry.
Hold my hand. Oh, baby, it's a long way down.
Delta Ray, Bottom of the River, from their first album, Carry the Fire. And that is one of Hadi Mawagdi's favorites. He's a producer here on The State of Things. We're looking back at 2014. And I'll continue that conversation on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, looking back at the year 2014, talking with our producers this week to hear some of their favorites of the year gone by. Our newest member of the staff, Hadi Mawagdi, is with us to talk about his best conversations from 2014. We heard some music from Delta Ray. We heard Chef Vivian Howard earlier in the program. What's next?
Well, the next few segments I have picked out for you are all pretty close to my heart for reasons that probably only a producer will ever understand. But the first is about the famous quilts of G's Bend, Alabama. When this was first kind of pitched our way, I think we all thought, a segment about quilts, that's going to be quite interesting.
Might have been me who gave you the hardest time.
Yeah, Hadi? I think it was.
We're going to talk about quilts on the radio? Really, Hadi?
Yeah, I think it was you. And I don't think anyone else in the production stopped you either. The funny thing about it was that these quotes really were quite beautiful. And when I got to speak to the women, I really got to see their beauty as well. And it really added to the story element, you know.
It is the feature of the program, I will say, that you were so passionate about this, that all of us were just absolutely awestruck in our ambivalence to the idea of talking about, and with mouths agape, we looked at you, and you were so passionate, you just wouldn't give up. So we all said, okay, if there's that much power behind it, we're letting you go. And you really heard something in this.
Yeah, I really did hear something. Speaking to Loretta and Louisiana, both natives of G's Bend, there was just something so honest in their voices, and you know, their understanding of it. From a different point of view, was just beautiful.
It was a great call. We're really happy we ran it, and here's why. Well, I understand that one of the differences between the two of you is Louisiana, you did not like quilt making so much. Loretta, you did growing up. Louisiana, let me start with you. This is a tradition apparently that had been going on all around you, but something you didn't particularly think you were going to be a part of. Am I right?
Yeah, you are right. I had to learn how to do it. And, you know, when kids have to learn how to do something, they really don't want to do it. But I finally realized in 2002 when the show started and my great-grandmother quilt was hanging in the museum, I finally realized it was something I had inherited from her, my mom, my aunts. And, you know, and so how could I not go back to doing it?
Where was that museum?
It was in Houston.
So you see this, when you first heard about it, I'm curious about this because, you know, you grow up, you're making quilts. As you say, you're working hard on a farm. And suddenly this thing is now, and somebody says, hey, do you want to go to Houston to see these quilts hanging in a museum? I mean, what ran through your mind when you first heard that these things were hanging in a museum in Houston?
Well, you know, even though I was older, I had never taken the time to go to a museum because we didn't grow up going to museums. And so when I got older, I just didn't visit one. So my mom asked me, did I want to go with her on a trip? Because, you know, and so I said, yeah, I would love to go. And so when I got there and saw quilts hanging on a wall that women in our community had done, and it was just, you know, amazing that people thought it was art and it was now hanging on a wall.
Loretta, now I understand that you loved quilt making growing up. Am I right about that?
Oh, yes. I was trying to be a mini mama. I tried to be like my mother, always trying to sew. And, you know, that was our job to just thread the needle at 6 years old or maybe even younger because we could see the eye of the needle better. But I just love trying to sew. When they'll discard some little pieces, I would try and put them together. So I enjoy doing, you know, sewing.
Well, let me ask you that kind of the same question that I put to Louisiana. The idea of this stuff is art. Growing up, you may have loved doing it. Did you ever see it as kind of a work of art? How did you view? I mean, what did you think of quilts when you were growing up?
I viewed them as something to keep us warm, because the houses wasn't insulated and we had wood burning heaters, and we just may had one in one room of the house, and so. Never thought it would be art. Not in 100 years. I won't say a million, not even 100 years. Never seen it as art.
And what did you think when you first saw it? You saw it in that museum in Houston as well, didn't you?
Yes. My whole family, we came down to Houston. And I was just blown away because I didn't think, you know, they still had all those old quilts. I knew that they had some, but not the ones that I seen on the wall in Houston, Texas. There was a lot of crying, you know, that first day when we got to see them. Couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it.
And again, you as somebody who loved making quilts, but as you said, you really never saw them as art. I mean, what did you start to think about the quilts in a whole new way? How did your ideas, or did they, your ideas about those quilts change?
At first, when we got there, I could not see what the people saw. What I was seeing, hard times. A necessity when I saw them on the wall. I just couldn't see them as art. I had to continue looking and looking. I'm like, what are they seeing? What do they see that we don't see? We thought a pretty quilt was a pattern quilt. And I just couldn't see it. But as I kept going to openings in different cities, you know, it clicked. I got it. And I started seeing, you know, the art in those quilts. I started seeing the beauty in them. And I was like, wow, it was like a light bulb came on in my head.
That's a clip from an interview earlier this year with Loretta Bennett and Louisiana Bendolph about G's Bend Quilts. G's Bend Quilts was an exhibit at the Center for Craft and Creativity and Design in Asheville. Of course, G's Bend is in Alabama. And so I will say publicly right here now, that is among one of my favorites, hearing the story of those quilts, of the history of, and how those the tradition of quilt making was one of the finest things we've done. So I will now say publicly to you, I'm sorry, I was wrong. That was great.
That's great. Thank you, Frank.
So what's next?
Well, can I just say one more thing about the G's Bend quilts? Later on in that interview, and I hope you all just go check it out online, Loretta says something about they make these prints with the quilts. And she says, you know, they change colors. And when they changed colors, it reminded me of humanity and how throughout the years, we start to change different tints and colors. And I was just like, man, how beautiful is that? You know, you don't have to go to art school to know that. You just got to got to live life. And I thought that was so cool.
Great stuff. Thanks for bringing it to us. So what do we have next?
Next, we're going to hear another Monday Meet. We're going to hear from Hanna Pikova, who is a UNC professor who immigrated to America, and she has a really brave story. She was living in Czechoslovakia, and what we're going to hear is a little clip of her running off from her parents and making a flee for the United States.
Well, at this point, I was 18, and I was determined to leave. I've had plenty of these indecisions all my life, and I was also worried that I was going to live in this regime forever without any opportunities. And it was not a question of ambition. I was not really ambitious, but I really wanted to have freedom. I wanted to study. I wanted to pursue kind of my life. So the person who was a German, actually, whose house we were staying at, he somehow intuitively understood my thought processes, and we agreed very quickly that if he takes me to the German border first, he'll help me to cross it and apply for political asylum, and that, of course, my parents would follow once they hear that I've done this. So that's exactly what we did. We drove secretly to the border with this German friend who was at that time maybe in his 40s. And then he called back home, called my parents, and called his wife and said, we just crossed the border and she has applied for a political asylum. And so then my parents, of course, got into the car and on that side of the they were still in Switzerland. I was in Germany already, and they were asking, "What have you done?"
You were talking about this aspiration for freedom and more possibilities for yourself and your future. Did you have particulars in mind? Did you see what that future was going to be?
Well, I wanted to study literature. Beyond that, I didn't really know much, only from books. You know, I read Jack Kerouac. I thought On the Road was fabulous. I had no idea what it really meant. But, you know, in the mind of an 18-year-old from Czechoslovakia, it has a totally different meaning than to an American of that same age. The other book that I thought was important, of course, was, and I already we discussed this, was Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis. And that was the other side of the coin, where I thought, when I read that book at the age of 16 or 17 in Prague, and it was a forbidden book, it was censored, I felt that in that system, in that totalitarian system, everybody is a bit like Gregor Samsa. So I didn't want to be like Gregor Samsa.
Trapped in this body where no one understands you and they can't quite hear you, and you're not particularly welcome in that system.
No, you're not welcome at all.
UNC Professor Hanna Pikova, who we met earlier this year, that means we spent an hour with her on a Monday afternoon, and is one of Hadi Mawagdi's favorites, a producer who produced that segment. I have a question for you. Those meets are pretty challenging because we have to spend 1 hour with one person, so it better be good. And that person needs to not only have a compelling story, but be able to tell it. And that doesn't always, you know, happen in the same person. You also spend a lot of time, producers, spend a lot of time talking with our guests beforehand to hear what that story is and get an ear for how it's going to go. I wonder what happens when you finally hear it on the air. You spend a lot of time. There's material that we can't ever get to that you know about. And what's it like for you to finally hear the final product and a truncated version of what you know about Hanna Pikova?
At first, it's nerve-wracking. You know, you're like, oh, no, is she going to get to that story? Or is she going to express the way she expressed it to me? You know, when we talked about her emigrating, it was all kind of sad when her and I talked. And when she talks to you, it really sounded a lot more brave and a lot more heroic. And And I don't think that Hannah would say that she was a hero. Like she said, she didn't have ambition. She just wanted to live life, you know. And that's, I think that's a big enough ambition for most, you know. And so at first it's nerve-wracking. But generally, I mean, it turns into something beautiful. I mean, meets are really hard and they're a lot of fun if they turn out well.
They usually do. So what do you have for us next?
Well, my next one's a bit of a controversial segment. It has to do with Bill Cosby. The Cosby Show had a 30-year anniversary this year. And I loved The Cosby Show growing up. It really connected me to the urban culture that I was involved in. And seeing young non-white people on television be successful was something that was important to me. And I think it was important to the two guests we had on, Duke professor Mark Anthony Neal, as well as St. Augustine's Natalie Bullock Brown. But with the controversy that's come up with Bill Cosby recently, I really fought whether or not we should have this discussion on our best of. But what it boiled down to was, you know, Americans loved The Cosby Show, white, black, brown, whatever it was. And I think that that love is what makes this also controversial. So
let's hear the clip.
I think looking back at The Cosby Show, one of the things that resonates to me is the fact that a real significant portion of the show had to deal with different parenting strategies. And as I became a parent, I began to appreciate some of the nuances that Bill Cosby and his team of writers brought to that conversation on television.
But they weren't just any parents, Natalie. This was an upper middle class African American family. How important is it, do you think, that they were an upper middle class family? Two professionals, a doctor and a lawyer, ran the household.
Right. I mean, I think it's very important because at the time that The Cosby Show first premiered, the types of images of African Americans that were prevalent in television, you know, did not reflect any sort of upper middle class status. So I think that it was very significant. And I think about how old I was when it first came on. And I think I was in eighth grade or ninth grade, but I went to a predominantly white school. And I just remember, you know, when it first came out, coming to school and everybody was excited about the show. And we were all talking about how cute Rudy was and how much we loved what Lisa Bonet had on. And, you know, we were completely engaged. And I think for someone like me who grew up sort of, you know, lower middle class, single mom, you know, but at this predominantly white, very rich private school, you know, the Huxtables reflected what I aspired to become. And so it was very interesting.
It holds a complicated place, though, doesn't it? I mean, there are these aspirations. It does bring an upper middle class black family to the attention of white Americans who may never have thought about it, on the one hand. On the other hand, it plays into a lot of stereotypes and perhaps aspiration on the part of Americans that we're past all of this now. See, here's what you can do if you just work hard and stick to the books, which could play against, especially for a young radical like you when you first saw the program.
I mean, The Cosby Show clearly carried the water for a lot of issues. Right. And Bill Cosby wanted that. I mean, he was very public about the fact that when he looked at the images, particularly of African-American men on television, right, you had the example of Fred Sanford, who was a junk dealer. You had John Amos, you know, on Good Times, who never had a job. And he clearly was trying to intervene in that conversation in a certain kind of way. You know, when he initially imagined the show, it was going to be much more of a working class family. But he chose, you know, as some revision, of course, he's bringing in expertise from, you know, the African-American psychologist, Alvin Poussant, and he himself, you know, has a doctorate from Temple. So he's bringing all of this scholarship, a lot of it having to do with African-American pathology, you know, to bear on the production of this image of an African-American family. The irony of The Cosby Show throughout its run is that, you know, it's popular in everybody's household. And it becomes almost evident that, you know, whatever social engineering had occurred around the civil rights movement, you know, the Cosbys embodied the most successful aspects of that, right? And the irony is that while all of this is playing out, you know, this is the beginning of the second term of the Reagan presidency. here you have an administration that is actively dismantling many of the kind of civil rights gains that would have allowed for the creation of a Huxtable family.
Well, and again, you can point to that. You point to the Huxtables and say, see, they've made it. Reagan's right. Let's just keep moving on our merry way,
right?
So, I guess realize the complicated place they hold, again, as an upper middle class family. The criticism at the time was that it was not overtly political, Natalie. But again, Bill Cosby hired a psychologist. He was. Do you think it was not political? Bill Cosby will say there is a political consciousness in this program. It's just maybe not what you want to see.
I think that the politics that were inserted in the Cosby Show were they were subtle, and I think that was for a reason. I don't think that the Cosby Show would have been nearly as successful as it was if Cosby had basically beat the viewers over the head with the issues of the day. But I think that he did. I think in presenting Black culture and I think there was an episode where Theo had some emblem of the anti-apartheid movement on his door. The older daughter, she names her kids Nelson and Winnie. Right. I mean, right. Things like that right. are reflections of that insertion of, you know, just some sort of hat tip to the fact that, you know, we need to pay attention to these issues. And I have, as you know, Cosby himself had a position, but he was not going to be overt with how he expressed that.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's so important about looking at the Cosby Show is that, you know, there's a tendency to think about that the Huxtables as kind of a Black family whitewashed. But the number of times that, you know, characters show up with T-shirts or sweatshirts from historically Black colleges and universities, you know, obscure paintings on the wall that art historians could, you know, you say, oh, that's an African-American painter there. The number of times that he brings in these kind of musical icons, you know, from Miriam Makeba to B.B. King to Sammy Davis, you know, it clearly celebrated, you know, at least in Cosby's view, the best of Black culture.
Duke Professor Mark Anthony Neal, along with St. Augustine's University Professor Natalie Bullock Brown. That's one of the favorites of Hadi Mawagdi, a producer on The State of Things, a program that we did about the anniversary of the Cosby Show. And, of course, that was before all the revelations and the allegations about Bill Cosby, the man, that have since surfaced. But I guess the relevance of the program, the impact of that program on the social consciousness and also just in pop culture is still relevant in some ways, although it is certainly something that now has become overshadowed by the allegations against the man himself. We're going to continue our conversation with Hadi Mawagdi, look at his favorites of 2014 when our program continues. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, our series of programs looking back at 2014 from our producer's view. Producer Hadi Mawagdi is with us today, and we've taken a listen to some of your favorites. What's next on the list?
Coming up next, we're going to hear an interview that you did with Congressman John Lewis of Atlanta, Georgia, as well as a co-author of his, Andrew Eidon, who worked with him in his campaign trail. They produced a graphic novel called March Book One, a series of books that are basically telling the autobiography of John Lewis. Quite an interesting life and quite a hero, I think, an American hero. And so that's why I picked it. I felt like we should hear from him.
Let's listen to this clip.
Well, it is important that we try to reach another generation of young people to understand, to learn, to be inspired the way we were inspired by a little book called Martin Luther King Jr. and the Montgomery Story. It was a comic book, 14 pages. It sold for 10 cents. I read that little book back in 1958, and it set me on a path to commit myself to the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence, to change America.
And I guess it's an important time in a young man's life. We heard you at the March on Washington saying that you had run out of patience. That's the hallmark of a young person, and I suppose that's when we want to capture people's imagination. It's right at that moment if we're expecting change, I suppose. Am I right?
You're very much so right. I didn't like the signs that I saw that said white men, colored men, white women, colored women, white waiting. I would ask my mother, my father, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, why? And they would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in the way. Don't get in trouble. But that little comic book and listen to Rosa Parks, listen to Martin Luther King Jr., inspired me to find a way to get in the way, to get in trouble, good trouble, necessary trouble. So what I said at the March on Washington on August 28, 1963, I said, you tell us to wait. You tell us to be patient. We cannot wait. We cannot be patient. We want our freedom, and we want it now.
You were speaking to America, but you were also speaking to the civil rights movement at that time, which was led by Martin Luther King and the SCLC, that were also urging you to be patient and you to calm down a little bit. So there was even tension within the movement that you had to navigate as a young man. Tell us about that.
Well, there were some people in the movement, some lawyers and some older leaders telling us that we're trying to push too fast. And there's some things that we shouldn't do or say. But we wanted to bring about what we call a nonviolent revolution, a revolution of values, a revolution of ideas. You can only be still so long. You see people who have been arrested and jailed and beaten. You saw people passing beautiful school buildings, riding broken down buses to school, and you had to be segregated, and you wanted to change that. Going downtown to the little town of Troy, Alabama, near where I grew up, on a Saturday afternoon to the theater, we, all of us little black children, had to go upstairs to the balcony, and all of the little white children went downstairs to the first floor. I didn't like it, and so I kept asking questions. And my mother just said to me, you're just nosy. You have a big head. You want to get in trouble. I just wanted to change things.
Andrew Iden, as a comic book fan yourself and now the co-author of March, Book One, what was it about Congressman Lewis's life that you thought would translate into a graphic novel?
Well, I grew up in Atlanta. Congressman Lewis has been my congressman since I was 3 years old. And even more so when I started working for him, I came to understand his story as something of a guide for young people today. He was so young when he was a part of these seminal moments and led many of them. 23 when he spoke at the March on Washington, 25 when he led the Selma to Montgomery March. And being around that age myself when we first had this idea, I kept thinking, how do we inspire young people today to understand their own power? And there was no story that I'd ever heard that had more importance to young people than his in inspiring them and showing them that there is a way forward for them.
And I think one of the things, you know, for those of us who grew up around this time, we at least saw news footage of the march across the Pettus Bridge, and we could see news footage of these stories. So for us, the graphics were on our TV sets every night, and now we can remember them. But I guess it's really important for people who weren't there to get the visuals, to see what this looked like, to understand what folks like John Lewis actually had to go through.
Absolutely. You know, graphic novels today are almost ubiquitous. We see comic books and movies. We see, you know, they're treated as literature. They're in schools. They're everywhere. And yet the civil rights movement itself isn't. And that's not right. 47 states, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center's most recent report, fail to adequately teach the civil rights movement. And if graphic novels are going to be accepted in schools, there should be one there that adequately teaches that story. And as we've heard over and over and over again, it's not just a graphic novel that children are told to read, but it's one that they want to read.
Well, I think that's the other thing, John Lewis, is that for people who come to the civil rights movement and study it as a kind of a historical period, people like you and Martin Luther King and the other leaders of that movement sort of seem to have come full blown out of whole cloth as heroes and leaders. You had some very trying moments, and for you, even learning to become a member of a nonviolent movement was a very scary prospect for you, and at one point, you didn't think it was possible. Tell us about that.
Well, growing up and listening to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on the old radio and meeting him in person when I was 18, meeting Rosa Parks when I was 17, it inspired me. But as a student with other students, we studied the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence. Every Tuesday night at 6:30 p.m., a small group of students, black and white college students, and some high school students, would meet at a church outside of Fisk University in downtown Nashville, where we studied over and over again. We had role playing. We had social drama. We studied what Gandhi attempted to accomplish in South Africa, what he accomplished in India. We studied Thoreau and civil disobedience. We studied Martin Luther King Jr. in Montgomery. And from time to time, there would be drama where people would pretending they were pouring hot water or hot coffee or hot chocolate on us, spitting on us, pulling us off the so-called stools at lunch counters and knocking us down. And that actually did happen during the sit-ins, during the Freedom Rides. But we grew to accept the way of nonviolence as a way of life, way of living.
Did you ever worry in the beginning of this training that you couldn't do it, that when people were spitting on you and calling you names, that you wouldn't be able to keep your hands at your side?
Well, I learned very early to make that commitment to the way of love, the way of peace, the way of nonviolence. And I never, ever thought or considered striking back. I wanted to be as disciplined as possible. I didn't want anything to hurt the movement.
Andrew, tell us a little bit about the collaboration and the people you worked with, including Congressman Lewis, to put the graphic novel together.
This was a period of time that we set aside that would normally be our free time because we believed in what we were doing. And as we talked it over, Congressman would tell me the stories. We would pull photographs and accounts from other places. And then we involved this unbelievable artist, Nate Powell, who is just one of his generation's great talents. And once that process began, we were all going back and forth, looking at pages, having these binders and these discussions on the phone. And it really became like we were a band of brothers working together to make this book happen.
Congressman Lewis, I wonder what it was like for you to see these drawings, these kind of graphic images that you lived through this story. The rest of us saw it on television, those of us of a certain age. And now there's this graphic representation, these drawings. What was it like for you to see those pictures? Did it look like what you lived through?
Well, Andrew stated it so well. When you have an artist like Nate Powell, this young man had the ability to make it real, to make it plain. And at times when I saw some of the artwork, I almost cried. In March, Book 1, there's the do's and don'ts of the sit-in movement in Nashville. And I remember so well the day of the first mass arrest, February the 27th, 1960, my first arrest. Each of us had a copy of the do's and don'ts saying, do sit up straight, don't laugh out, don't talk back, obey your leader. The sign's so simple, but it was so meaningful. And every single one of us on that day made a commitment to the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. 89 of us were arrested and went to jail. And when I was arrested, I felt good. I felt liberated. I felt like I had crossed over.
That's part of a conversation I had with Congressman John Lewis and co-author Andrew Iden about their graphic novel, March, Book 1, and one of producer Hadi Mawagdi's favorites of 2014. And I guess it illustrates something else about the show. Of course, neither one of them are North Carolinians, but they were here with March, Book 1, as part of the Durham Reads Together program. And they also came to the city to help launch the Durham Reads program. And part of the lifeblood of any state is not just who was here, but who we bring here and who we think are important enough to bring to the state. And I think part of what we try to reflect on the program as well.
Definitely. And the message that Congressman Lewis is trying to get across in that book, I mean, it's beautiful, you know, to dedicate yourself to love, to say that, to know the exact date of the things you I can't remember the exact date of anything I've ever done. So it was just beautiful to hear all that. And, you know, graphic novels were really big in my life as well. My brother, as bad as it sounds, used to steal me comic books from the corner store every week. Like, handfuls of comic books he put in the back of his pants and brought home to me, and I read them. And eventually they became graphic novels like Persepolis or Rat, which was about – Persepolis is about a woman in the Middle East. Rat is about living in Nazi Germany, you know, and now we have an American version of stories that can tell people how to make a difference.
It's great, great stuff. Final pick?
Final pick is another music pick, and it's a pick from the Lone Bellow, which is a band we had play here a couple of weeks ago. Beautiful performers, beautiful voices, and great cohesive sound. But their story is really interesting. Their lead singer, Zach, his wife had a horse riding incident where she became a quadriplegic, and luckily she had a full recovery, and, you know, she's living a beautiful life now. But, you know, you think about that, it's like his wife becomes a quadriplegic, they moved to New York, and then they become this world-renowned folk band. Like, you couldn't be better on TV. If it was on Nashville, it wouldn't even be believable, you know. So it's just funny to see, and it was beautiful to hear, and a pleasure to have them in the studio with us.
Well, Hadi, it's been a great year, a great pleasure to have you on board, and I'm so happy that you're here. And by the way, some of the ones you picked are among my favorites as well. So we're going to go out with the music of the Lone Bellow, but first I want to say that this is Hadi Mawagdi, whose name you hear often at the end of our program when I say this program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, Will Michaels, Alex Curley, the intern, Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stasio, and here's the Lone Bellow.
Single letter that I wrote, let the pages turn.